All right, I want to welcome everyone to part 17, Great Rabbis of the 20th Century, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib, and I thank them for sponsoring this year's series as well. Tonight's the season finale, looking at the life and times of Rav Aryeh Levin, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So Rav Aryeh Levin lived a life of hardship, of at some points dire poverty, almost never held a formal job, except officially he was Mashgiach Ruchani at Yeshiva Eitz Chaim in Yerushalayim, and even there he mostly served in the elementary school. He gave a daf yomi, he taught other shiurim, but he never really had a formal job that would make him one of the great rabbis of the 20th century. And yet when he died in 1969, right before Pesach, at the age of 84, tens of thousands of people attended his funeral, including the President of Israel, the Prime Minister of Israel, cabinet ministers, Knesset ministers, the IDF Chief of Staff, and numerous generals and other high-ranking officers, soldiers, myriads of simple Jews, and not least, all the great Rosh Yeshiva in Yerushalayim and throughout Israel. There you found religious Zionist Jews, non-Zionist Jews, Haredi Jews, and even not yet religious Jews. It's impossible to think of another person who attracted to his funeral such a diverse group, especially a funeral where such attendance is not required, like that of a major politician. So how did Rav Aryeh Levin attract all these different types of Jews? There's several answers. One, he was renowned as a tzaddik. Menachem Begin, with whom he had a very close relationship for decades, said of him after he died, "What is a tzaddik? When a man appears and you watch his ways and his actions carefully and you are enchanted. You listen to his words and they touch your heart. You look at his eyes and they're clear and pure. You touch his hand and you're drawn to him almost magnetically. Then you say in your heart, this is a tzaddik." Secondly, you can't escape number one, he became renowned as the rabbi of the prisoners. He actually had two nicknames, Rav Asirim, the rabbi of the prisoners, and Av Asirim, the father of the prisoners. And he was noted as a Mevaker Chola as well. He started doing that in his early years, the 1920s, and then he became the chaplain to the political prisoners, especially in the decade before independence, and to downtrodden and persecuted Jews, but visiting them every Shabbos. And by every Shabbos, I mean every Shabbos without fail. He became their advocate, their secret messenger, and their main source of hope and comfort. He would daven with them, learn with them, speak to them about their families and their futures. And thirdly, he was just known as a tzaddik because of his deeds and his personal probity and the simplicity of his life and his bitachon and the way he interacted with people and shunned all types of honor. His biography in Hebrew is a classic, simply called Ish Tzadik Hayah, and its English translation, A Tzadik in Our Time. And he never would have approved of the book or the title. He's one of the most beloved Jews of the century, whose 50th yard site was just commemorated this past April, right before Pesach. And as a result of that, he was profiled by one of his grandsons, Rabbi Benji Levin of Gesher, in Jewish Action, and the stories about him are inspirational. So he writes that a young man that Rabbi Aryeh Levin had known his entire life, even attended his bar mitzvah, rebelled and took off his yarmulke as part of his rebellion. Once he saw Rabbi Aryeh walking on the street, and embarrassed, he ducked into an alley to avoid him. And Rabbi Aryeh chased him into the alley, caught up to him, and said, "Did I ever do anything to hurt you? Because I notice you're trying to avoid me." And the young man answered that he was embarrassed to see Rabbi Aryeh because he was bareheaded. Rabbi Aryeh took his hands And when he held someone's hand, he would take the hand, put both palms around it, and caress it. And he said to this fellow, "You know, I'm a short man. I can't see what's on top of your head, but I see what's in your heart." And the fellow said that everyone else was haranguing him, family, outside the family, making him feel inferior. But Reb Aryeh was so sweet and sensitive, it convinced him to put his yarmulke back on his head. So how does a person become a tzaddik? All right? Wouldn't we like to know? Without an entourage, without a PR team, without a social media presence, without tweeting righteous things, and without even a formal position to necessarily put him in the public eye. And he wrote very little. That's why you see the reader has almost nothing of what he wrote except the bottom of his tombstone, which we'll get back to. He wrote a commentary on the Mishnah, he knew the Mishnah by heart. And towards the end of his life, he was asked by people close to him to record memoirs, his experiences, and then he did. But he wrote relatively little. So how does such a person become a tzaddik and a gaon? And that is the story of Rav Aryeh Levine. His early life was filled with hardship. He was born in the Polish town of Urla on the 6th of Nisan in 1885. His mother was Etel, his father, Rabbi Yamin Beinish, who was a Talmud Chacham, but a logger by profession. And he was also fairly elderly, so the father was gone most of the week. He too was recognized for his tzidkus. But after he retired from his job, when Rabbi Aryeh was still a child, he retired because of old age, he couldn't chop wood anymore, the family lived in utter penury even before his father died. He would often go hungry, and in his early years, he just learned with his father, with tutors and others, but at a young age, he had to go learn Torah in neighboring towns, where at least he'd be able to find food in local homes. And he became accustomed, before he was a teenager, just to sleeping at his shtender in the Beis Medrash. When he was informed by a relative that his bar mitzvah had come and gone, he went and borrowed a pair of tefillin, and then he began saving coins each day until he could buy his own. So after he left Urla, he first learned in a small school in Brisk, and then he was rejected for admission in Volozhin as too young. He was probably 13 or 14 at the time. And he began to travel the circuit. He first learned in Slutsk, where Isser Zalman Meltzer was the Rav. They would later reconnect in Israel. Rav Aryeh was so coy about his room and board, or better said, his lack of room and board, that many years later, Yerushalayim, after Rav Isser Zalman recalled this young man, he broke down in tears, and he begged forgiveness for how he, Rav Isser Zalman, treated Rav Aryeh, not knowing, he said, that Rav Aryeh was sleeping at a shtender and eating just 4 days a week, which he did in Slutsk. And Rav Isser Zalman cried and cried, even came to see Rav Aryeh in the middle of the night, until Rav Aryeh assured him that he holds no grudge. But on the contrary, he owes Rav Isser Zalman a great debt of gratitude for allowing him to learn in Slutsk, especially after he was turned down to Volozhin. So he left Slutsk, making his way to Slonim. He only got as far as Prozhino, where for a lack of funds, couldn't move any further. Slonim is a little northeast of Prozhino, it's not far. And he spent his 15th year learning with Rabbi Elia Feinstein. Then he went to Slonim, and then to Minsk, and then to Halusk, where Baruch Be'er was at Rosh Yeshiva. And finally to Volozhin, where he learned with Rev. Rafal Shapiro. He was an outstanding Talmud Chacham, a point that's often overlooked because of his ethical greatness. He left Volozhin in 1904, about 19 years old, spent a difficult year at home. The family's cow, an only source of sustenance, died, a source of milk and butter, and then his father died, and they were left with nothing, and then he decided to make Aliyah, both for the obvious reason, and because, in order to avoid the Tsar's draft, he was now conscripting troops to fight against Japan, the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. So he had to beg money, even to get to Israel. He wound up as the only Jew on a ship from Constantinople, with hundreds of Russians. On the ship, he fell seriously ill. He had to be hospitalized and taken in by the community in Constantinople. But he finally arrived in Israel alone, 1905, and headed straight for Rav Kook's home in Yafo. They had an incredibly close and warm relationship, and Rav Arye suffered for this as well later in life from those extremists who were vehemently opposed to Rav Kook's derech. But he credits Rav Kook and being in Rav Kook's presence with his enormous sensitivity to people and their needs. In one very famous vignette, they were strolling through a garden one weekday afternoon. Rav Kook always did that daily to clear his mind and to commune with nature and the Borei Olam. And Rav Arye absentmindedly plucked a leaf or a branch from a tree. And Rav Kook was taken aback by the sight. And he said that in his entire life, he never cut short the life of even a blade of grass or flower, as long as it had the ability to grow. Like Chazal say, every blade of grass has a malach that's commanding it to grow. Every part of nature sings its own song to the Creator. Rav Arye, chastened, said these words, became so engraved on his heart that from then on he felt compassion towards everything. He soon went to Yerushalayim. He learned in Taras Chaim. He came to the attention of Rav Shmuel Salant, who gave him smicha. He gave him smicha, as did Rav Kook, as did Rav Chaim Berlin. Rav Salant's klaf was replete with such praise of Rav Arye that a few years later he tore it up, fearing that it would fill him with too much pride and harm him on the Yom HaDin, listening to all this praise. And this too was a hallmark of his personality, intense anova, humility. The commander, this is many years later, the commander of the IAF's helicopter division once came to him for a bracha, and Rav Arye refused to give it to him, saying, "Who am I to bless you? Your merit in heaven is greater than mine." He never allowed himself to be photographed, well, here's a picture, until once he gently stopped a photographer from taking a picture of him, and someone said to him, "No, that's a new Ole from Vilna, and this is his Parnassa." So he said to him, "This is your Parnassa, take as many pictures as you want." A reporter once dedicated his weekly column to Rav Arye and his deeds, and he sent him a pre-publication copy. And Rav Arye demurred, and he said, "Your intentions are good, but I've searched myself thoroughly and found nothing of note or value. Any good I've done has been repaid 100 times. And he urged him to find someone else to write about. Ma'od, ma'od, hevi shvel ruach, the Mishnah says. He should be exceedingly of lowly spirit. And that defined his character. But he would have said that one of the greatest influences in his life into making him into a person was his wife. Shortly after he came to Israel, he married Chana, the daughter of David Shapiro, the Kovno Rav. She was educated. She spoke and wrote several languages, but they were perfectly matched. He called her a great neshama. Her sister married Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, the Rav Yerushalayim, so they were brothers-in-law. They had many hardships. Several children of theirs died young. They suffered from literal starvation during World War I, when the old yeshuv experienced awful privations. They just went hungry for days on end. And the stories about how she never asked for anything. She would put a pot on the stove Friday afternoon, so people walking by would think that there's food in the house, even though they had no food. Rav Arye said of his wife that she accepted all Yisurin Ba'ahavo, all her suffering, with love, and even more with joy. And she exceeded him in bitachon. And when he was down, and he writes, he was down quite frequently because of their material circumstances, she lifted him. So, example, during the difficult times of World War I, he went to a local gvir to ask for a loan, and the man turned him down, not because he thought that Rabari wouldn't pay back, although how he would is a different issue, but he said, I lend to other people, because if I don't, they'll hold a grudge against me. But I know you won't hold a grudge, so why should I lend you money? So he returned to his wife in tears, and he said to her, because I won't hate anyone in my heart, I'm condemned that my family must starve. And she said to him, Aryeh, where's your bitachon? Does it make any sense someone would give such a reason to deny you a loan? That's not normal. So you have to be done l'kav zchut. Something else is going on here from heaven. Well, wouldn't you know, a few days later, he got a check in the mail from the U.S. for the exorbitant sum of $10, which supported them for months. It was left to him in a will by a man that he had met who told Rab Aryeh that he greatly admired Rab Aryeh's grandfather. That's bitachon. When a second child died, two neighbors came to console her, and she was so stoic that they said to each other in Russian, speaking Yiddish until then, that she must be a little touched in the head, that it's not registering these tragedies. And then she answered them in fluent Russian. Don't you hate when that happens? She answered them in fluent Russian, all about Avelus and about Tzedek HaDin and accepting God's judgments. And that's how she lives her life. And this, think about it, it's an incredible story. Years before, she was in Kovno when her mother took ill and died. So her sister went to Israel, and she stayed to look after her father until he remarried. And then she went to Israel. But before she left, her father gave her the double rope of pearls that belonged to her mother, saying, I want you to have this. Back in Israel, her sister asked her, hey, whatever happened to mother's pearl necklace? And Chana saw in her eyes the backstory to the question, her yearning for it. So she said to her sister, Father gave it to me to give to you. And she just gave it to her. And only her husband, and later on her children, knew what had happened. That is a tzedekes. She pushed him, she encouraged him, and she supported him in everything. When she died in 1952, she was young, only in her 60s, his world darkened. He was once in a cab with the mayor of Yerushalayim, who overheard this exchange between the driver and Rab Aryeh. Where's your home? No answer. Where do you live? No answer. So then he said, where should I drop you? And only then did Rab Aryeh give the address. And when the mayor questioned him after they exited the vehicle, he said that the Gemara says, Ishto debisu, my wife is my home. Since she died, I no longer have a home. So I couldn't answer his question honestly. He asked me, where is your home? He asked me, where can I drop you? That's a different issue. It was Rab Aryeh, this everybody knows this story, who took his wife to the doctor and said to the doctor, my wife's foot is hurting us. He wrote about her that she never saw any evil or sin in anyone. And she made friends with the downtrodden. She was kula chesed, kula kedusha. His home in Mishkanot, which is today called Nachlaot, was one small room. Hey, Michal was there. She got him in a bigger room. One small room with a table and a bookcase and a bed and a little alcove that was the kitchen and a tiny bathroom. And even that was only later in life, earlier, for the first few decades of their marriage, they lived with all the children in even a smaller home, which had only an outhouse in the courtyard. But there they raised their children. Most well-known, his son, Reb Chaim Yaakov, who became the rabbi in Jersey City, educator of Gilda Winters, among others. And then he became the Rav in Pardes Chanim, went back to Israel. And his daughter, Shaina Chaya, who married the illustrious Rav Yosef Shalom Elyashiv. So Rav Elyashiv was Rabbi Levine's son-in-law. All his seven surviving children were either Rosh Yeshiva or married Rosh Yeshiva. But if there's one thing for which he stood out, it was his Avat Yisrael. He loved all Jews. And he didn't grade or rate Jews according to any categorization, certainly not the definitions and labels we use today. He saw only the person. He first put this trait to good use when he assumed the position that he would hold for more than 50 years, the Mashgiach Ruchani at the elementary school of Yeshiva Eitz Chaim in Yerushalayim, brought in by Rav Yitzchak Zalman Meltzer in 1925. So his job was to inspire more than to teach, and to extract the good in every student, and to arrest any negative tendencies. And he was tender and sensitive, and somehow he always knew the right words and the right approach. Rabbi Wein wrote about this story that was witnessed by someone who then, I guess not 20, 30 years ago, was a leading educator in Israel, and then he was in the dorm. He was a young Talmud in Eitz Chaim. So he witnessed what happened. The food was very meager and not very tasty. There was one young boy who was always hungry. One day the yeshiva served chocolate pudding, it's a delicacy. He ate it quickly, and then he got back in line for a second time for more. And the server refused to give him a second portion, adding a choice insult. The boy became so angry that he threw over the entire chocolate pudding pot onto the ground. And he was beaten, he was reprimanded, and he was threatened with expulsion, his fate to be determined by Aryeh Levine the next day. And of course the boy was petrified the whole night. Next morning, Rabari took him aside, and he asked the boy to sit next to him. And he asked him, "Did you spill the pot?" And the boy said, "Yes." And then he said, "Will you ever do it again?" And the boy said, "No." And then he said, "Do you really like chocolate pudding?" And the boy said, "Yes." And then Aryeh said, "I also love chocolate pudding. I brought with me two packets. Will you have one with me?" And they ate together, the boy and Rabbi Aryeh Levine. This educator said, at that moment, he's a young kid, at that moment, I realized what it means to be a Torah Jew. That was his way. He would greet everyone on the street, everyone. He who had, you could see his eyes, his smile, people always noted that. He who had nothing would always have guests for Shabbos. And he had nothing. And his son, one of his sons, quoted Rabbi Aryeh saying, something to think about in Teaneck, if you only have one room in your home, you have enough space for a guest. If you have two rooms, then it's much harder to accommodate. If you have three rooms, then you and your wife wind up eating in the kitchen. And if you have four rooms, then you go eat in a restaurant. If you think about his logic, it makes perfect sense. He excelled in every aspect of chesed, even of the superhuman variety. He would visit Yerushalayim's hospitals every Friday, and he began, in fact, in the 1920s, visiting the leper hospital when no one would go, and he couldn't even shake hands with the patients. It was in Talbia. He would talk to them, and he would learn Chumash and Rashi with them. And then he realized that there are very few Jewish patients in this Christian-run leper hospital, and he arranged for kosher food for them. He would visit the mental hospitals and always had a soothing effect on the patients. Another son related this. Once he's walking on the street with his father, and the director of an asylum stopped him on the street and said to Rabbi Aryeh, "Your relative is doing well." Rabbi thanked him, and the son asked Rabbi Aryeh, "What relative do we have in a mental hospital?" So Rabbi Aryeh answered that he was once visiting the patients there, and he saw this man who was all abandoned, no family to visit him, and very often he was wild and uncontrollable, so much that the orderlies would abuse him. And he saw that, and he told the orderlies and the director, "Please take special care of him, because that's his relative." Out of respect for Rabbi Aryeh, they did that. And from then on, he visited the so-called relative weekly and looked after him. Once met an ENT doctor, a religious Jew, carrying his bag on Shabbos to see some patients, and he walked with him, and then Rabbi Aryeh asked him, "Can he carry his bag at least, so he should have a share in the midst of healing the sick?" And the doctor confessed, and he said, you know, sometimes I resent having to see patients on Shabbos. And when Rav Aryeh said that to him, he realized the great value of the mitzvah, and the resentment in him completely dissipated. He made a special point of visiting wounded soldiers and was filled with appreciation and admiration for their sacrifice. After the Six-Day War, he greeted one wounded soldier so effusively that the soldier asked him, from where do you know me? And Rav Aryeh answered, we all stood at Sinai when the Torah was given. That's where I know you from. He was a very ill widow, young woman actually, who lived in his neighborhood that he would visit regularly. And knowing that she would not want to eat on Yom Kippurim, one year he left shul in the middle of the day, dressed in his talis and his kittel, went to her apartment, prepared her some tea himself, gave her biscuits, and told her she had to eat and drink, and he can't leave until she does. And she complied. Soon after, she was hospitalized, unconscious and near death, Rivka Weiss was her name, in Shaar Tzedek, and he went to visit her. And he saw that her bed was surrounded by partitions, meaning that the doctors had given up hope. And he was distressed, and he put his hand on the mezuzah, and he started davening. You, God, who are Dayan Almanos and Av HaYisomim, the judge of widows, the father of orphans, this widow is all alone trying to raise her children. How can you take her life? And he stood there davening for 30 minutes and then left. He came back a few days later, and the nurses said a half hour after she left, after he left, she opened her eyes and asked for water, and a few days later she was completely recovered. In his later years, the health ministry tried to arrange transportation for him as he made his rounds. He was never paid for any of this. And he declined, saying that now that he's elderly, his Torah learning no longer sufficed to give him any merit, so at least he at least wants the schar halicha of walking to do Bikur Cholim. He would counsel couples. Never went to bed before 2 in the morning. Then he davened vasikin, so he got 3-4 hours of sleep a night. And he explained that many couples might be embarrassed to have people know that they're seeking help, so late at night they won't be seen. They come to see him midnight, 1 in the morning. He would work tirelessly to repair broken marriages and to arrange new ones. A religious man that he'd met, had met a tourist, fallen in love, but his parents met her and were not impressed. Her benching was a little rusty. Rav Aryeh asked to meet her, and after told the young man, tell your father, this woman has tremendous emunah, a strong belief in God. Tell your father not to be concerned about her benching. You should marry her, and I'll be Masada Kiddushin. Yitzhak Shamir, in the underground, he was one of the heads of Lehi. This is one of his disguises. He poses a rabbi. You see the pictures. Beard, hat. In fact, that's where he took the name. He was Rabbi Shamir. And he would meet an aide in Lehi, a religious Jew named Moshe Segal. He was the one who had blown the shofar illegally at the Kotel in 1929. So he would meet Moshe Segal in a shul in Rechavia. They'd sit over Gemaros, and they'd exchange codes and information and strategy. There was a young girl who acted with Shamir as an intermediary, but with great devotion. So Segal said to Shamir, who was younger than he was, why don't you take an interest in her? And Shamir said he can't marry anyway because every wedding has to be recorded and he's a fugitive from the British. They don't know where he is, who he is. Segal went to speak to Rav Aryeh, who consulted his brother, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, and they worked it out that he would be registered in secret. And so it was. Shulamit and Yitzhak Shamir married in secret. Chana Levin prepared the food, and Rav Aryeh was one of the Eidei Kiddushin. He would lecture on Shalom Bayis issues. Once he was told that in a certain neighborhood, there were men who were not treating their wives properly, and he asked to speak on Shabbos between Mincha and Ma'ariv. The offenders were there, as was Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, who came for the Musar. After he finished speaking, Rabbi Zalman thanked Rabari after the shiur and said to him, I know you were talking about me. He said, my wife always writes down my chidushim in her very clear handwriting so they can be published, and I have a tendency to get angry if she makes a mistake. Now be more careful, as were presumably the men who were his real target audience. He would speak about blending love and intimacy, about husbands and wives lavishing praise on each other, showing appreciation, mutual respect. Once, after he counseled a couple, the man sent Rav Aryeh a donation for the yeshiva, and he returned it and said to him, use this money to buy clothing and jewelry for your wife. It's money better spent. So he was once spotted at Haram Nuchot. You ever been in Israel? If you walk through Beit Yisrael and Mea Shearim, you ever see these station wagon with a loudspeaker calling on Jews to come to a levaya? Rav Aryeh was once at Haram Nuchot, and he was asked whether he knew the mace. And he said no, he just heard a loudspeaker calling on all good Jews to come, be malaf the mace, so why wouldn't he go? He once saw a Chevra Kadisha removing a body from Shari Tzedek en route to the cemetery with no one in attendance. And that was intolerable to him. And he stopped the Chevra and he started eulogizing the mace. And people saw Rav Aryeh and they stopped to listen. And before you know it, a crowd was escorting the mace to the cemetery. It was a woman. He would make a special point to visit the widows of rabbis on Chol HaMoed, because when their husbands were alive, their houses were filled with well-wishers. And so on Yom Tov, they especially felt the loss much more keenly. It's exquisite sensitivity. He visited Rabbanit Herzog every Monday for the 10 years after the chief rabbi died. In the 60s, when Ariel Sharon endured his multiple tragedies, his wife and one son were killed in a car accident, then another son died in a gun accident, someone suggested that Rav Aryeh invite Sharon to his home to talk, because he was broken by his ordeal. And Rav Aryeh would hear nothing of it. And he said, no, I have to go to him. And they drove him to Sharon, and they spoke, and he unfortunately knew what it meant to lose children and a wife. When he noticed that the home lacked any mezuzos, he sent several to Sharon's home. And Sharon was so grateful, he made a special trip to visit Rav Aryeh in the hospital during his final illness. I don't doubt that if Rav Aryeh was alive, Sharon's history would have played out differently as well, especially his end. But his most famous position was as father of the prisoners. And this began already in the 1920s, when there were very few Jewish prisoners, and the British realized there was an Arab Qadi, but no Jewish chaplain. So the British turned to Rav Kook, and Rav Kook asked Rav Aryeh to serve. And he did on one condition, that he not be paid for it. And he never took a grush. Even worse, in the early years, thief that he'd seen in prison, Jewish thief, got out, he was released, had no money, nowhere to go. And Rav Aryeh said, I'll get you some money, come to my house for dinner. And we'll and sleep over in the one room. And we have some, well, we'll get some money for you in the morning. Rav Aryeh asked him to spend the night. By the middle of the night, the man was gone with Rav Aryeh's silver wine cup and his wife's silver candlesticks. When Rav Aryeh realized that, he awakened his wife, told her what happened, and said to her, let's resolve now, firstly, to forgive him. And secondly, that this incident should not prevent us from inviting to our home other thieves in the future. You can't let the one thief, you know, besmirch all of the thieves. He would not only visit, but he would talk to each prisoner. In fact, when the Arabs, being before in the years of the underground, when the Arabs became jealous because their Qadi would enter, he'd say a few prayers and he'd leave, and they saw Rav Aryeh spent hours, he spoke to each prisoner, learned their name. Rav Aryeh started visiting the Arab prisoners as well, saying they also have a Tzelem Elokim. In fact, late in life, he donated money for famine relief in Biafra. And when he met one of the doctors who'd gone to treat the sick and suffering, he extolled the Kiddush Hashem and said the doctor has a zechuyot that he can't even dream of. Then he gave him even more money. In the early years, it was basically criminals he was visiting. By the late 1930s, most incarcerated Jews were political prisoners. And Reb Aryeh became their advocate, certainly in the religious services, you know, kashrut and the like, even gave them his own Sefer Torah to use on Shabbos, a little Torah that he had that disappeared and only recovered it decades later. But even generally, he viewed the fighters for independence as all tzaddikim, and he would visit them every Shabbos, but every Shabbos in the Russian compound. He would daven early, vasikin, and then he would walk over, and he would talk to every prisoner, and he'd learn with them. He would comfort them. He would read the Torah for them, in fact. Secretly and illegally, he passed messages between them and their families. His wife had sewn him in his long black coat. He had a number of hidden pockets in which he could take these messages back and forth, and they never searched him in any event. After the visit, he would then visit every family that lived near Yerushalayim to give them the news of their children, even before he went home. His family would not eat the Shabbos meal until later in the afternoon when he returned. He also went to the hospitals on the way back. There were Jews, you know where the Russian compound is, you walk up Rehov Yafo, he'd stop in Bikur Cholim, and then he'd go home. There were Jews whom he saved from execution due to his personal pleading. And when he could not save some whom the British executed, he would grieve uncontrollably, calling them tzaddikim like the Haruge Lod. He would visit members of all three underground movements. It didn't matter to him. Someone tried to have him fired from Eitz Chaim, one of the right-wingers, because of these Zionist activities. And he went to the Chazon Ish to enlist the Chazon Ish support in firing Reb Aryeh Levin. And the Chazon Ish said to this man, leave him alone, leave Reb Aryeh alone, he's a tzaddik. When he insisted on attending the execution of Meir Feinstein and Moshe Barzani, Shem Yikom Damam, they blew themselves up prematurely, meaning the plan was they wanted to blow up their captors with them. They'd hidden a bomb in a cutout, I think it was an orange. But when they heard that Reb Aryeh was coming, they refused to risk his life. So they blew themselves up before he came and before the time of execution. And Reb Aryeh actually sat Shiva for them in his home, even though their families also. He maintained connections with these prisoners for his entire life, attending their weddings and smachot. That's why he was so close to Begin and Shamir and the establishment leaders. Even insisted on accompanying the prisoners when the British exiled some of them to Eritrea, but he was overruled and he was not allowed to join them. It was simply remarkable. Famously, during the Milchemet HaShichrur, after the massacre of the 35 fighters from Gush Etzion, some of the bodies could not be identified because they were so brutalized by the Arabs. So they buried, I think it was 23, they could identify them, and 12 could not be identified. So he was asked to identify them. Rav Goren turned to him through the process known as the Goral Hagra. Goral Hagra is you take a Tanakh and you flip back and forth pages. It's a prescribed formula. And then where you come up, the seventh turn seven pages, this way, that way, then the seventh column, the seventh line, etc. Looking for clues. He stood over each body, and amazingly, he found clues for each one. So for example, he stood over one body, and he came across the pasuk from Shmuel Aleph, Halo Benyamini Anochi. One of the dead was Odei Benyamini. Another pasuk, Kol HaNefesh Haba LeYaakov Mitzrayma, Yaakov Ben Atar, VeLizvulun Amar, Yitzchok Zvuloni. It's amazing. They knew the names of the dead, but they couldn't identify the body. For each of the 12, a remez in Tanakh was found by Reb Aryeh. It would not be believable except by mystics, but for the fact that it took place in the company of eyewitnesses. In the end, a name was attached to every corpse, and some measure of solace was brought to each family, and all are now buried on Har Herzl. It was both a sign of his greatness and the esteem which he was held, that Rav Gard, who was the chief rabbi of the IDF then, reached out to Rav Arya Levine. He visited the prison camps during the week, the internment camps, Lutron, Atlit. It was a life devoted to people and to chesed. He didn't just do chesed. In the words of his grandson, Rav David Levine of Netanya, he embodied chesed. He was kulo chesed. And he told his grandson that nothing came naturally. He had to work for years on each midah tova. Shouldn't think he was born like this. In addition to the prisoners, he would visit hospitals every Shabbos. And one would think that it would have a harmful effect on family life, on children, etc. And the opposite was the case. The esteem they had for their father and grandfather was boundless because they saw him as completely occupied in the world of Torah. He had such amazing people skills, always knowing just what to say. And such people are quite rare. So rare that his grandson wrote in the Jewish Action a few months ago that he once interpreted for his grandfather, he was visiting for the summer, he once interpreted for his grandfather and an English-speaking American. And when the man left, he asked him who he was. And the man answered his name. And the young Benji Levine asked, "What do you do for a living?" And he answered, "Oh, I'm the publisher of the New York Times." Why would Arthur Hay Sulzberger trudge to Mishkano just to meet Rav Arya Levine? And he told the grandson he heard about his reputation and he just had to see it for himself. Young man was sentenced to life for a crime he committed, talking about knowing what to say to people. And his wife wanted a divorce, and he refused to give his wife a get unless he was paid a large sum of money. Couldn't be budged. No one could persuade him. And Rav Arya visited him and spoke to him in a friendly manner and then talked to him directly. And they said, "You'll never get any money because there's no one to pay it. And besides, even if you got the money, you can't spend it here anyway. But you're going to spend every night wondering if your wife is faithful to you, and why should she be?" And the young man was so taken aback by coming from this Rav in the beard and the black coat that he authorized the get that night. Yisrael Eldad, who was one of the three heads of Lehi, along with Shamir, Netanyahu, and Moore, wrote that when Rav Arya visited the prisoners, he asked for each one by name and from memory, and he's talking about hundreds of people, and they would run then in search of them to find them, and he would lead them in mincha. And later they wondered, even during the week it would happen, they wondered why when Rav Arya said, this is Eldad speaking, "Hashiva shofteinu kavari shona, restore our judges as in the days of old," people actually cried. And then Eldad writes that he realized, because when he read it, he meant it to sound like a subversive act. "Hashiva shofteinu kavari shona," that the day would come when in a free Israel, they would have honest judges, not like the Brits. And so the words read as if the listeners were hearing them for the first time. And he never took a dime for this work either. Even in the 1950s, when the government wanted to put him on the payroll as an official prison chaplain, he declined, saying that it would cheapen the mitzvah. And the schar mitzvah, in any event, was more valuable. How he supported himself? Nisim. Nobody knows. Visiting, he got by with very little. Visiting Latrun on an unbearably hot day, the men were dressed, as one described it, like Tarzan, loincloth. They saw Rav Arya walking up to Latrun, you can see from a distance there, and he was wearing his long black coat, and they ran back to their barracks to put on a shirt and pants out of respect for him. After Mincha, he said to them, "I don't come here to burden you. If you change your way of dressing because of me, then that is not good." He had this effect on people. Once he shook a prisoner's hand on Shabbos, he held it, he caressed it, while the guy held a lit cigarette in his other hand behind his back for a few minutes. Later that day, he sought out Rabbi Aryeh and told him that was his last cigarette on Shabbos. He'll never smoke again. Another Jew who carried out the same promise was named Matityahu Shmulevitz, who had been sentenced to death by the British. And through Rabbi Aryeh's pleadings and others as well, the sentence was commuted. And he then sent a letter to Rabbi Aryeh asking him to thank the chief rabbis for their intercession. And then he wrote this: "Yet there is one person in particular to whom I remain grateful first and foremost, a dear and precious Jew about whom you told me nothing, but it was he who stormed heaven and earth for me. And more important, it was he who brought me closer to my Maker in these fateful days. This precious, dear precious Jew, however, whom I will not name, but who was so beloved by all the prisoners for Israel's sake, has made that closeness of us all to God something clear and obvious. He sent this letter to Rabbi Levine, and of course he was talking about Rabbi Levine, but so as not to spare him any discomfort, he left the name out. And as it turns out, this Shmulevitz, who gave up smoking as well on Shabbos, had never davened or worn tefillin his entire life. When his sentence was commuted, Rabbi Aryeh greeted him with a gift, a pair of tefillin that he smuggled into the Russian compound on Shabbos. He did on Shabbos because he was afraid the British would not let him visit during the week. And Shmulevitz began putting on tefillin every day, and he writes, he did it for a long time. It could be a certain point he stopped, but he did it for a long time. It's impossible to describe the love he engendered in people. One Shabbos, he left prison early. He cut short his rounds. Turns out the only time that ever happened. And mind you, he did this for 50 years. He learned that one of his daughters had been stricken with paralysis. Next Shabbos he returned, and as always he read the Torah for them. And after each aliyah that called Mecha Mishaberach, the Ola pledged. The first guy pledged a day in his life for refuah for Bari's daughter. And the next a week of his life he'll give. A month of his life, until one man pledged the rest of his life just so Rabbi Aryeh should have no anguish. And with that, Rabbi Aryeh broke down in tears. The last man, by the way, was Dov Tamari, who later became a professor at the Technion. This incident was witnessed by a U.S. Supreme Court justice who was visiting in the 50s. A convicted thief was up for parole. He was asked by the judges whether he was morally strong enough not to steal again, and he said yes, his life had completely changed. Good? Then he added, "I'll be honest with you, I feel I have to commit one more theft." To the astonished judges, he said, and this the Supreme Court Justice heard, "I have an inner need to steal a gold watch just to give it to Rabbi Aryeh Levine because he brought me back to the good and decent path." And with all that, he suffered the scorn of the anti-Zionists, but he never responded. And he always sought the good in them as well. And a very clear formula in life. He once said, "What does it take to bring joy to another person?" It's very simple. A friendly handshake, a kind smile, and a warm word. That's all it takes. So it sounds so obvious, but I don't know if we're as successful at it as he was. It's not my place to say, but it's clear he had Ruach HaKodesh. So, because these are true stories. He was very close to Avram Stavsky, who had been falsely accused of the Arlozorov murder and was freed. And the Nebuchadnezzar was killed on the Alta Lane as well, 16 years later. A few years later, in the late 1940s, Aryeh was suddenly beset by a recurring dream. Stavsky was appearing to him in a dream, happened three times. He appeared to him in a dream, and he told him that his wife, his widow, had moved to America and was about to remarry, had no children, but he had a brother no one knew about, and so she needed chalitza. Rabbi Aryeh contacted then Chaver Knesset Shmuel Tamir, one of the leaders of the Irgun, and he said he'd look into it. He never heard it. Sure enough, Tamir discovered that Stavsky had a brother living in Israel. The widow came to Israel, received chalitza, and then returned to the U.S. to marry. It's amazing. Also amazing. He once visited Rav Kook, and Rav Kook was distressed because the straps on his tefillin shel yad had snapped. And this tefillin that Rav Kook had received from the legendary Yerushalayim Sofer called Rav Natanel Sofer. I guess that was a nickname. It could be his last name for all I know. And Rav Natanel was already dead. What to do? And Rav Arya said, what a coincidence. He had just visited Rav Natanel's widow, who was impoverished, and he wanted to give her money in a respectable way without embarrassing her. And he said, is there anything that you have that I can buy from you? Anything your husband left over? And she said, my husband left no tefillin, but he did leave over two straps for tefillin shel yad. And Rav Arya bought both, and now he said, Rav Kook, look, I have one for you. And he went home and he got it for him. Gula Cohen, a famous Ergunnik, mother as it is of Tzachi HaNegvi, wrote of Rav Arya. Rav Arya, by the way, visited the women's prison as well. You can have a lot of the hang-ups that people have today. There was a women's prison in Beit Lechem, where the women political prisoners were kept. He visited there also. That's where he met Gula Cohen. She wrote of him, Harei lo al shuma tova shua salanu. His greatness is not that he did good things. Elami shum shehu asal tanu tovim. He made us good people. In his presence, one could not help but become a better person. In fact, the truth is, you can't read the book A Tzaddik in Our Time without becoming a better person. And we have two copies in the Beis Medrash, in fact. He visited the Kotel with great emotion at least once a week after the Six-Day War, and he lived with an intense longing for Bias HaMashiach. He used the tefillah that he said he overheard from a venerable Sephardi Rav late in life, and he would daven over and over again, Ribono Shel Olam, if my sins are holding up the final redemption, then let my death be a kapara for all of Klal Yisrael. But it seems like the opposite. Rav Kook said of Rav Arya, if there were three Jews like Rav Arya in our generation, Mashiach would come. He always refused, besides money, he always refused any type of honor. When the city of Yerushalayim wanted to pay him tribute as an Ezrach Kavod, a citizen of honor, he refused. And they said to him all the reasons. It's not you, it's this, that. He explained to all those who entreated him that he can't. Kavod is in the very title, Ezrach Kavod. So he's fleed from Kavod his entire life. How can he accept this now? The only quasi-honors he accepted was when his beloved prisoners paid him tribute on the occasions of his 70th and 80th birthdays in the presence of the dignitaries of the state of Israel. And that we find in our reader 1 and 2, beginning on the left. So it was on the left, was actually written by the Mordechai Shmulevitz. I'm sorry, Matityahu Shmulevitz. This is the scroll given by those imprisoned for Zion in the days of the battle for freedom into the hands of their rabbi and source of solace, Rabbi Ari Levine, at the completion of 70 years of his life and 50 years since his arrival in the Holy Land. And it goes on. I mean, what else? Beautiful words. We ever thirsted behind the bars to see your countenance. We became prisoners of your heart, and we imprisoned you in our hearts. And he goes on. Beautiful words. And here's a copy, number 2, of the scroll they presented to him when he turned 80 in 1965. V'zot ha-megillah asher notnim asirei tzion mimelchemet ha-cherut ha-yadav shel rabbam me'oraram, their rabbi, their inspiration, Rabbi Levine Shlita, now that he's 80, 60 years since his aliyah, and it's beautiful poetry. Rabbeinu, mechazkenu, b'vacha b'gvorot, our rabbi, our strengthener, and now that you've reached the age of gvorot 80, heveinu l'chayom, churot churot, we give you these praises, compliments. Et melo nafshotenu ki lecha misurot. Our entire soul, because we are devoted to you. Shayiti manu bimei merorot. You are with us in the days of bitterness. Einecha mechashke atzinok mirot. Your eyes were able to brighten the darkest moments, Yadecha merachachot ayadenu shasharot, your hands soften the chains around ours, Ruach nishpat lochamei gvurot, your spirit lifted those of the fighters. Hafachta lemikdash tekel barod, you turn the cells and pits into a mikdash. Lanu gesher hayita ilai ale kedem dorot, you are a bridge to eternity. V'kesher tefila l'kagvurot, and the connection of tefila to the God of the Mighty. U'v'zchut avatcha otanu b'tzarot, and merit of your love for us in our tribulations. Od tizkel avasreinu b'meirah b'tzarot, we had merit to greet quickly the good tidings. V'adlik al harei Yerushalayim midorot, to light bonfires the Mount of Yerushalayim, likrat Mashiach bandivit shevo l'gvurot, to greet Mashiach will come in strength as well. He never received any honor. I mean, after he died, the street on which he lived was named for him, the yeshiva Beit Aryeh that was run by one of his sons-in-law. He spent much of his last year in Hadassah Hospital suffering from multiple ailments. He fell, he broke bones, he had cancer, etc. He insisted on continuing to do what he always did. He insisted on being wheeled to the memorial ceremony in the hospital when Prime Minister Eshkol died just a few months before Reb Aryeh did. His daughters would cook him food because you know what hospital food is like. And when they would leave, he would give the food to the fellow patients, saying that if he doesn't eat the hospital food, other patients might think he's questioning the kashrus. When visitors said to him that in his merit he should be zocha to stand again and greet the Mashiach, he responded, "There are many more worthy people who can greet Mashiach. I only want to be able to stand on my own feet so I can go to shul again, morning and night." Are the Jews like this? He said that a true Yerei Shemayim is one who lies awake at night worrying, what did I do today to relieve the suffering of another Jew? And look finally at his tombstone. It's in the cemetery in Sanhedria, where Karen's grandparents are buried also. His name, birth date, date of death. And then he says, writes at the bottom, Ani mevakesh mikol mi sheyavo l'shtatech al kivri, Shema v'pemalei, ask everyone who comes to stand at his grave that they should say out loud, Ani ma'amin be'munah shleima, I believe with perfect faith, she'tiyet chiyata meitim be'eid she'taleh ratzom et ha'barit barach, that there should be, the resurrection will come when it's the Creator's will, and his memory will be elevated forever and ever. And this is from his tzava, this is from his will. All right. Why? Why do you think he asked people to pray for the resurrection at his grave? Why do you think? He explained to his children that visitors come to the cemetery and it's impossible that they don't become despondent. You relive the death in some respect, they'll become despondent again over the loss of their loved one, and he won't be able to comfort them. See, he said, let our belief in Tchias HaMeisim, in the resurrection, be his consolation to them. They shouldn't lose hope, they shouldn't be depressed, there's a beautiful end ahead. He died on the 9th of Nisan, Erev Shabbos HaGadol, in fact, 1969, aged 84. He had requested no hespedim, and in fact none were offered. It was Nisan, Erev Shabbos, but true to his sublime greatness. The family wanted, he died early morning. The family wanted him buried late morning, so that people would be able to get home for Shabbos. The old cemetery in Sanhedria feared that the earth was so hard that it would take hours to dig, and so they asked for a delay to the afternoon, but the family insisted, and they dug the grave, and they found that the earth was unusually soft. And yes, the grave digger said, 4 years earlier, an elderly man came and asked him to dig the grave and then refill it with earth, lest he die on a Friday and people will be inconvenienced, and they'll have to delay the funeral. And note, he owned plots on Har Zeitim, and he refused to be buried there because his wife had died between 48 and 67, 52. Couldn't access it. She buried him in Sanhedria. So he waived those graves, and he said he wants to be buried next to his wife. That type of prescience, greatness. It was Rabbi Aryeh Levine who had come that day to visit the grave of his wife. What a Jew. What a legacy. What an influence. And what a Jewish world we would have if there were more like him. Ish tzadik haya, yehei zichro baruch. All right, I want to thank everyone for joining in the series this year, and we'll pick it up again, I think, great rabbis of the 20th century after Yom Tov as well. So thank you all.